But don't we all wish we had an introduction to life like that?
Yeah. I'm clearly not the cool one up here.
My name is Brian. I am the lead teaching pastor at Christian Fellowship Church. A lot of you here because you know Steve one way or the other. I just get the privilege of kind of walking us through a conversation tonight. But I have to tell you something. So I want to tell you how I met Steve. A lot of you met Steve through Netflix. I met Steve because this man is obsessive at the Ashburn Panera early in the morning. I as well is obsessive. Pastor Mike is obsessive at the Wegmans. I am obsessive at the Panera in Ashburn. I'm there a lot. And Steve's part of Christian Fellowship Church. I'd see him a lot. We'd talk. We'd hang out. And so one day, I said, man, I was at an appointment. He'd always be at appointments. I said, we should grab coffee. Mm-hmm. So we set an appointment. We grab coffee. And so
I paid.
You paid. That's true. Is that true?
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Right. Don't lie in church, brother. Anyway.
It's not my church.
So, very nice. Very nice. Very nice. You can tell where this night's going to go right from there, right? So we were sitting there talking, and it's a fairly common thing when I'm just getting to know someone that I'll say, hey, what can I pray for you about? Because once I get to know them, I kind of know the things to pray. And so I get to the end of our conversation, and I said, well, Steve, hey, what can I pray for you about? And Steve got really, really quiet. Now, I have to tell you, most of the time as a pastor, when you ask someone, what can I pray for you about? And they get really, really quiet. They're about to confess something. You just need to know that, right? And so we practiced our not surprise face, right? Because you don't ever want to be talking to your pastor saying about something that you're really struggling with, and your pastor go, oh, wow, that's bad, right? No, you don't want that. So you practice that face really well. And very humbly, Steve began to tell me about an opportunity that God had placed in front of him about a story of his life that Netflix wanted to make a movie. I have to tell you guys, I don't normally fail the pastor face test, but I failed it when I realized I was sitting across from the DEA agent responsible for the takedown of the world's first narco-terrorist, Pablo Escobar. So, Steve, thanks for sharing your life. For those people who just kind of know you a little bit from TV and that sort of thing, give us just a couple quick things about you, Steve Murphy, the guy who walks into the house and she says, have you taken the trash out? Not like, hey, you don't walk into your house with theme music is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, you don't. No, you don't. And today I did the laundry, just so you know. So, first thing that it's kind of strange growing up, but you're kind of proud of later in life is I'm a PK. Does anybody knows what a PK is? I'm a pastor's kid, except my father was a Southern Baptist minister that graduated from Bob Jones University in the 50s. So I didn't go to my first movie until I was 16 years old. My sister, my older sister, didn't wear pants until she moved out of the house after she was 18. But you know what? As a kid, that's the way you grew up.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with it.
We both kind of grew up that way. We have the statement, fundamental, right? And we said, no fun, a lot of damn, very little mental is how we grew up. There's a lot of grace that God's given us both in our life.
Yes.
You have four kids.
I do.
We'll talk about two of them in a little bit. You wonderful, wonderful wife, Connie. As Steve always tells you, and you, if you meet Connie, you need to tell her that Steve said his wife is more attractive than his TV wife. That's
please,
very important.
Please.
Every guy needs to know that. She's a wonderful lady. Now, when we talk and I get a chance to know you and get into this, a couple things you always say. First is he doesn't necessarily recommend narcos because he can't control the content, especially of what they show about Pablo Escobar, right? So because it's real in some ways, but there's not necessarily things we should be watching. So just this isn't a plug, but it's a reality. But the other thing that we talk about is that when I ask you kind of, well, help me understand, what about if you got on Netflix and you watched this show, Narcos, it's somewhat biographical about your story. You're the voice that, or at least the actor's voice that's overdubbing that preview that we just saw. How real is it? And this is basically what you said. It's one-third true, one-third kind of true, and then there's a Southern term called one-third bullpucky. That's kind of, you called it what though?
Literary license is what Hollywood calls it.
Yes, it's one-third literary license. But the reality is we've talked about this, you know, that's really true about guys. Can we be honest that most of us as men, one-third of our life is true. One-third of it is kind of true. And then one third of our life, let's just be honest, we live a little bit out of literary license. What people think we are, not really who we are. We're more impressed by impressions than the reality. And tonight we're going to talk a lot about what's true, what's kind of true, what's not true. And specifically for us as men, the importance of what it's like to try to live your life in that first third, that which is true, not living your life in those other parts that we often are very tempted to do. Mm-hmm. So we were going to have some pictures and stuff, so just use your imagination tonight on some of the stuff we'll describe it. But that's kind of how we're going to walk through a little bit of if you've seen the show or you know a little bit about the story, about what's true, what's kind of true, and what's not true. So we'll start with that, Steve. Okay. True. When people watch the show, there's a lot of really, really gruesome things that happen on that show. True, not true.
Very true. Very true. And one of the things that Netflix did well is capture the violence. So if you've seen, just out of curiosity, how many have seen Narcos? Oh, that's good. Because last year when I would ask that question, I'd say, you know, not that this is self-serving, but the more times you log on, the longer my contract goes. Well, my contract expired and it didn't work. So
you didn't log on enough. So yeah. Nice. Is
watch it if you want to. I don't care now. So, but if you saw it, you saw the violence. And I've had a lot of people come to me, and the part where it got to where the prostitute was kidnapped and very brutalized, and that was hard for everybody to watch. But a lot of people, especially ladies, have said they couldn't watch any farther past that. But the sad reality of that is it was true. Things like that happen, and they still happen today. You know, we're in a very protected area here in Northern Virginia, but, you know, Mexico's as wild as it gets.
Yeah, and so when we're thinking about some of the massive stuff, and these are some of the stuff we were going to have some pictures on that we don't have, but kind of talk to us a little bit about the lengths to which Pablo Escobar would go to make sure that, number one, he stayed in his position that he had, but number two, the big thing was to keep himself from being extradited, and we'll kind of dig into that.
Right, and that extradition, that was the key. That was the key behind the whole violence and the whole war that Escobar raged against his country. And keep in mind, this is a guy who declared war on his country twice, called the president and said, "I declare war on you." I mean, think about that here in the United States, what would happen? I think the Secret Service might pay you a visit. But here's a guy, he was so violent, he put a bomb on an Avianca airliner. That's the equivalent of American Airlines or United or US Air or whatever commercial airline you guys fly or that I fly, simply because he thought a presidential candidate was going to be on that flight. He killed 110 innocent people thinking he was going to get to one person who wasn't even on the flight. That's the length he would go to. He put a 500-kilo bomb, and we figured that up in U.S. today. What was that, 1,100 pounds?
Yeah, about 1,100 pounds.
So I graduated schools in West Virginia, so my math's not real good sometimes. and he didn't want me to take my shoes off in here to count. So. But seriously, he put a 500-kilo bomb, truck bomb, outside the headquarters of the equivalent of our FBI. It's called DOS. 500-kilo bomb. Just blew the entire building. The whole front facade is gone. Simply because he wanted to kill the head of DOS, one man, General Maza Marquez. And did he succeed? No. He tried to kill General Maza 9 times. General Maza is still alive in Colombia today. He, that presidential candidate we were talking about, his name was Luis Carlos Galan. He was the leading presidential candidate in Colombia. My partner and I, we do these talks around the world now, and we refer to Galan as the JFK of Colombia. All indications were he was going to have a 90% vote towards him. It was just going to be a landslide to put him in office. And he was pro-extradition. So that tells you that the public was in favor of extradition, right? So what did Pablo do when the man's up on the stage, just like we're here tonight? He had his gunman shoot him dead right in front of all the people. I mean, we just go on and on. There's some of the photographs we're going to show you. Have you ever heard of Murphy's Law? Well, I'm Murphy, and it's true. So, and then you guys that I've worked with or that know me, know it's true. But we would go out on patrols, and the weapons that we came across were just unbelievable. The Stinger missiles, RPGs, hand grenades. I'm out there with a 9mm Smith & Wesson. And, you know, you're coming in on these helicopters on these raids, and you're getting ready to jump out, and the Columbia National Police, they've all got Uzis and Galil 7.62 rifles. And I got my 9, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do, make everybody mad?
Yeah.
It's like a little bee sting.
Yeah.
And just one other point on the violence. I can't describe, that's where the pictures would have been so valuable. It's hard to describe the level of violence. And Pablo was so proud of it, he actually had calling cards made. And it was then later, the leader, or the name of his group that he was the leader of, he called the Extraditables. And on that card it said, "We prefer a tomb in Colombia to a jail cell in the United States." That's how violent this guy. So when they'd set off a bomb or kill someone, throw that card down there, because he wanted credit for everything that he was involved with down there. That's the kind of monster this guy was.
Yeah, and when we dig into it, you'd have criminal informants. How many of those did you lose while you were there?
Unfortunately, we lost 6 informants. And when Pablo kills somebody, it's not just an out-and-out kill them, shoot them, and they're dead. He has them tortured because he wants to know everything they know about him. One particular case that we were going to show you a picture of tonight was one of our informants. Not only was he tortured, but then he was, parts of his body were cut off. Then he was killed, and then he was burned, and they always leave him out where they can be found because it sends a message. So being a DEA informant in Colombia in the late 80s and early 90s was a very high-risk position.
Yeah. Now, I imagine most of you haven't sat in a church building and said, wow, this is the type of stuff we normally talk about at church. We're going to connect this, right? But kind of laying the groundwork, because, right, you know, all of us have jobs, most of us do, and we got some tension, those sort of things. What's interesting about your job is it wasn't like you just went to Colombia by yourself. Mm-hmm. Connie was with you, right?
Absolutely. In fact, she gets the credit for giving me the okay that we could go to Colombia. Because, you know, if the wife's happy, life's good. So I heard her here for that. That's good.
Yeah, that's Randy. I know Randy's wife, so yes, that's agreeable. That's right there. So these are some things that are true. You know, for people who want to, like, get in a little bit more of this, want to see some of the pictures, maybe weren't able to see or dig into some of the history of that, there's a National Geographic special that they just shot, right?
It is. It came out the same week in September as season 2 of Narcos. It's called Facing Escobar. And my partner and I have been in a lot of documentaries and media interviews and things like that over the years, and this is probably the best documentary I've ever seen, and I'm not saying that because I'm in it. But they interview some people that have never been interviewed before. So one is General Vargas Silva, who was the head of the Colombian National Police, never been interviewed. This was the brains behind the whole operation towards the Medellin cartel and Pablo Escobar. They've got General Maza Marcus, the guy that Escobar tried to kill 9 times. He's interviewed in there. They have the former U.S. ambassador to Colombia, Morris Busby, who has been interviewed, but only maybe once. So it's just incredible to get those bodies. But the last guy that's in there is a guy that's called Popeye, and that's one of Pablo's sicarios. And in Spanish, sicario means assassin. Okay, so Popeye was convicted. He took advantage of the same deal that Pablo got, which we've termed the deal of a lifetime. And what that was is if they would come in to the attorney general, they were allowed to plead guilty to one crime of their choosing. Okay, so Popeye came in and pled guilty to one crime. Well, Colombia, the maximum penalty is 30 years in prison. They don't have a death penalty. So he goes to prison for 30 years, and this is following the escape that happened in the middle of 1992. And about 2 years ago, he was released for good behavior. So this is a guy that admits to killing 300 people. 300. This is a guy who admits to coordinating the murders of as many as 3,000 people. And he's a free man walking around Colombia. Now, if you watch Facing Escobar, and documentaries you don't get paid for, so there's no personal gain here from me promoting this, but it really is a good one. Watch Popeye when they interview him, and you tell me the next time I see you if you see any remorse or guilt in that man's face or in the tone of his voice or in his mannerisms. That is one cold-blooded murderer. He will say he will brag about how many people he's murdered on that show. And at the very end, he talks about how many police officers they kill. I mean, the guy remembers that they killed 540 cops, 540 police officers, and wounded another 800. Now, we were talking today, how in the world do you keep track of that? I don't know where the numbers came from, but you know what? I believe him. So if you get an opportunity, just watch that. It's scary.
Yeah, and all of this is to balance extradition and obviously to keep in the cash flow. So for those people who don't understand the scale of what's going on, how much was Pablo Escobar worth on the low end, they estimated?
The low end was $8 billion, with a B, not an M, a B, $8 billion. The upper end was $30 billion. Now, I was a cop for 38 years. You know, right now I've probably got $60 in my pocket, and it's because I'm traveling a lot, and that's all my wife lets me have. Okay, so I usually don't have money in my pocket. I can't even fathom how much money that is. I can't even dream in my mind what that kind of money is like. But you look at the lifestyle that led to him, I don't know that I'd want that lifestyle.
Yeah. And so if you're kind of painting the picture of some of these sort of things, I think for all of us, part of our lives, part of the things that we do, we have tough decisions. And would we agree? I mean, in whatever realm that we're in, whether it's in our home, whether it's our job or whatever, and you had some uniquely tough decisions. And they portray that fairly well about true things in the show. Especially, though, about, I can't even, we were talking about today and it just blew me away. I think all of us as men have trust issues. Can we agree sometimes we have trust issues as men? Some of us are nodding, the rest of you are sleeping right now. But, you know, come back, just like, right? It's hard, right, sometimes. Now imagine trust issues and putting it into a scenario where the people that you work with, you don't know who's on the take and who's not on the take, right?
And that was one of the challenges. That was one of the major challenges. So I had already been in law enforcement probably 16 years by the time I went to Columbia. And that was in June 1991. And my first concern was, who do we trust down here? Because this is, you know, it was a third world country back then. It's Columbia is completely different today than what it was. And let me just say, you know, we're talking all bad about Colombians. Let me just say right up front, there's like 1% of Colombians are bad. 99% of Colombians will bend over backwards and sort of some of the nicest people in the world as long as you go in and try to get along in that society. It amazed me how my wife got along because she couldn't speak Spanish, but she'd go shopping, she'd take things back, she'd barter prices. It was amazing how she got along down there. And you can tell she's the leader of this family because she's a whole lot smarter than me. But when we got there, you're working with the Colombian National Police, and the only Colombians I ever met were the ones I put in jail in Miami.
Yeah.
So you get there, and I was partnered up with my partner, Javier Pena. Well, he'd been there for 3 years. He'd already earned the respect of the Colombian National Police, and simply because he vouched for me, I was accepted by the Colombian National Police. There was a very small group of guys, about 15 to 20 guys that we worked with on a daily basis that ran the telephone intercept rooms, it's a telephone wiretaps, basically, what we were doing down there. And just so you know, that wasn't legal back then, but we weren't doing it. It was Colombians doing it. So. So who do you trust of those guys? Well, when we would fly into Medellin, most of the times we would fly, this is during the second manhunt. So this is after Escobar has gotten his deal of a lifetime. He's in his custom-built prison. Then he kills a couple guys in prison because he didn't like the way they were doing business, and he escapes. Not sure how he escaped when you got 600 military guys surrounding a small, you know, 10-acre prison, but it happened. I think it might have been something to do with this, but
yeah, but more than
my
that,
$60.
Yeah, I see a dollar bill there. You're gonna have to come
yeah.
with that, right?
I carry a lot of ones. Makes me feel like I got money. But when we would fly into Medellin, most of the time they'd pick us up in Huey gunship, and it had the 30 cows in the door, you know, and that's pretty cool. But when the helicopters were all tied up on operations, they'd send three cars to the airport to pick us up, and we had to drive across this curvy mountainous road to get in the city of Medellin, because it's kind of built in a bowl. If you ever see a picture, it's literally like this, but it's a huge bowl. It's beautiful, too. So the first time they picked me up, Colombians have a real hard time saying Steve, so it kind of comes out like stick, you know, and I'm a lot of things, but you can tell I'm not stick. But that was my nickname. And so I'd get in the car, and they'd say, Stick, do you have a gun? Yeah, I got my 9mm. Well, like, get it out. Why? We're not encountering any targets right now. And they said, this is the way we work in Medellin. You need that split second to be ready to engage targets should an attack come along. That's how violent and dangerous this place was. Now, 20 plus years ago, that was really exciting. Today, I look back and think, boy, that was really stupid. But you literally drove in the car with your weapon up here on your chest. And, you know, of course, you put your left-handers on this side of the car because their weapons are pointed out those windows, right? So I figured that out. But so that's the people we had to trust.
Yeah.
Now, after the fact, there were two majors in charge of that small unit there that were in charge of that whole group and you know, we collaborated with on a regular basis. After Escobar was dead and the whole thing was over, we moved back to the United States. We found out one of the majors was actually working with the Cali cartel in Los Pepes. Now, we knew from wire intercepts that Pablo knew that Pena and Murphy were in Medellin, that we were working with this big group, 600-man force called the Bloque de Búsqueda. We knew that he knew that we had the Army's Delta Force, Let me tell you, those are some studs. And we also had the Navy's SEAL Team 6 down there with us. So if you ever get kidnapped, those are the guys you want to come and get you. I mean, those guys are like muscles with legs and a brain walking around. I take my hat off to those guys. Those are the tough guys of the world, in my opinion. So you knew all this was going on, but one of these majors is working for the bad guys, and all he's got to do is make one simple phone call, and you're a dead man. You know, they send a car up to pick you up at the airport with guys you've never met before. They kidnap you. They take you out and shoot you. So we survived. So
those are tough decisions, then.
It was tough to know who to trust.
So with that, there's a question. If you Google, and some of you will now, Steve Murphy and Pablo Escobar, put it in the same Google, and it comes up and hit images. One of the very first images that will come up, you standing, or actually kneeling, over Pablo Escobar and his dead body, as well as a couple other pictures where Colombian National Police were standing around, and they're posing and smiling. And there's an interesting tension, right? Because law enforcement, serve and protect, serve and protect. You don't ever get into it to take a life. So when we talk about tough decisions, one of the things that as we've talked, that you get asked a lot is, how could you, as an officer of the law, take someone's life? Well, I understand that, but then how could you sit there and be smiling about it? And it comes up pretty often.
It does.
And that really kind of plays into the day in and day out sort of reality of the world that you lived in and what it meant in that moment that Pablo Escobar's life had been taken.
So I have caught a lot of grief over the years from this photograph, and it made the front cover of Semana magazine, which in Colombia is like their Newsweek, and they didn't say good things about me, and it's been around quite a bit, and you can imagine in government, I got called on the carpet quite a few times, but it was more like, don't do that again. You know, it wasn't anything severe because everybody was happy. But here's what I tell everybody, because we travel around and we do question and answer periods at the end, and a lot of times, depending on the audience, cops I never get this from, but depending on our audience, people will say, you represent yourself as a career professional law enforcement officer. You carry the title of public servant, which I carry as a badge of honor, regardless of what you think about public servants. Anybody that gives up their life to serve their fellow man, I think that's a badge of honor and that's something to be proud of. But their argument is, and as a police officer, you have sworn to serve and protect your fellow man, protect against death. But yet here you are in that photograph holding him up by the hair of the head and smiling about it. What do you have to say to that? Well, here's what I have to say. And am I right in the eyes of God? I probably not, and I ask for his forgiveness quite often, and I believe he's forgiven me for this. But the facts were at that time that Medellin was the murder capital of the world in 92 and 93. The entire world, the murder capital of the entire world. We saw so many innocent people killed. Escobar, we estimate, and I don't even know how these numbers came up. It's amazing how Washington comes up with these numbers. But the best guesstimate is that Escobar is responsible for between 15 and 20,000 deaths. A lot of it has to do with car bombs. This was the world's most wanted criminal. This is a guy that introduced car bombs into the criminal element. That was always a terrorist activity, not a criminal activity. So it's like the difference between law enforcement and CIA. We have different missions, okay? But if you go out to some of these sites where these car bombs went off, and there's one in particular that I'll never forget. My wife will never forget it either. Pablo set a car bomb off in front of a mall on 15th Street in Bogota, up in the north end of the city. The mall had a complete glass facade on the front. It was a block, it was a city block, not a neighborhood block, a city block long. And it happened to be a day when mothers were bringing their children to the mall to get their books and their crayons and their pencils to start school again. And that bomb went off. And you go to the site and you see all the lifeless bodies of the children, the moms there, the infants, you know, that the cops and the firemen are carrying, that, you know, really haven't had a chance at life yet. That sticks with you the rest of your life. Now, it does cause you to lose sleep, and you get used to it, and you get over it. But we knew immediately, not tomorrow, not soon, we knew immediately that day that when Pablo Escobar was killed, every citizen in Colombia was safer immediately, simply because one man was dead. Within a couple months of his death, we saw the murder rate in Medellin plummet by 80%. So the statistics bear out what I'm saying here. Was it right to pose with a dead body and smile? Yeah, probably not. Probably not the best decision I've ever made. But I hope you understand where I'm coming from on this. It's not to glorify death. It's not that at all. But it was to know that you had a hand in protecting, you know, the citizens of an entire country. Not to mention the other deaths that are attributed to that as well. Yeah. So those
are some things that are true. Now, we could spend a whole lot of time talking more about things that are true. But then let's kind of move, though, to that second part, the things that are kind of true, mm-hmm. right? And I was joking with this afternoon. There's a picture, and we have a picture of your two daughters that you adopted and said, you know, that's kind of true. And that's what he says. Well, no, it is true. I adopted two daughters. I got to make sure that's clear, right?
Yes.
Because if you don't follow the right rules, that's not adoption. That's kidnapping, is what he said.
That's what they showed in the show.
Yeah, so talk about a little bit about that.
Well, if you've seen the show, there was a little girl named Olivia her dad was brought on as a confidant of Pablo. And I think he was actually portrayed as the guy that put the bomb on the Avianca flight, that activated the bomb, not knowing he had a bomb in the briefcase. And then the mother, you know, they don't leave witnesses, and that's true. That's the way these people do business, is they don't leave witnesses to anything. So they go, in the show, they go back and kill the mom, and that leaves this little baby there, and they're getting ready to kill the baby, and then we get in this big chase, and that's Hollywood. That's that part of that literary license.
Yeah.
So we did adopt a little girl. Her name's not Olivia. Her name is actually Monica. That was her first daughter, and that was her given name. But if you believe what you see in the show, that would be called kidnapping, because you can't just go take a kid just because his parents were killed. You can't take that kid and bring it back to the United States.
Yeah, but you did. You adopted two daughters.
I did.
One before Pablo, mm-hmm. one after in that way. They live right here in Ashburn mm-hmm. with you, which we're not right here in Ashburn, but over there a couple miles there in Ashburn.
They're the reason I have no hair left. Yeah. You fathers know what I'm talking about, little
right.
girls.
So there's other things in the show. Like, one, you actually had a cat, a real cat. You actually brought a cat. God bless you. You brought a cat overseas.
Yeah.
You must really, either your wife really loves that cat or you really loved your wife. I'm not sure which, but you brought the cat overseas. On the show, they make this big thing out to, like, you know, someone killed your cat to intimidate you and that sort of stuff. Not so, right?
Well, first of all, my wife made it very plain the cat was there before I was.
Okay, yes.
So that's why the cat went to Columbia.
Yeah.
And so if you've seen the show, we did take the cat. His name was Puff, and we did have a really hard time getting him through customs and immigration and all that stuff, even though he had all the paperwork. So that it was actually worse than what was portrayed on the show. And Puff did die in Columbia. And in the show, they portray it that a sicario had broken into our apartment, killed Puff and left him hanging on our front door.
Yeah.
Well, he did die there, but Puff had a heart attack, died of natural causes. So that's kind of true, but not quite true.
Yeah. I'll lie to detect you later if it was really natural causes. But anyway.
I was with my wife.
Yeah.
Trust me, I was scared of her.
Yeah. There's a scene in the show where you're in a vehicle and you start getting tracked by someone there in Columbia. And they do this really big thing, and, like, you shoot the tires out of that sort of stuff. Kind of true, right?
Yeah, kind of true. It wasn't a taxi cab, and there were shots fired. I was on my way home, and I drove, if you remember the old style, the big Broncos, the big Ford Broncos, had the big West Coast mirrors on them. That was kind of G-car, government vehicles we drove, so a G-car is a
good one. Those who aren't there, just think OJ white Bronco, right?
This is what we're pretty much.
Okay, this is what
except
we're
it was black.
Yeah, exactly.
It was black. And so, you know, it's armor plated. It's got steel plates all over. It's got these windows that are this thick. You can't roll your windows down. And I'm driving home from work from the embassy, and I've got a million things on my mind, and we're in the middle of the Escobar hunt, and I've got enemies everywhere, you know, because I'm a gringo in the middle of this Hispanic nation. You know, and I mean, you can tell I got light-colored eyes. I'm English-Irish, so you don't get much whiter than me, and I'm taller than probably 90% of the people in that country. So I kind of stick out like a sore thumb. So I'm driving down the road in this Bronco, and this little Volkswagen all of a sudden starts messing with me. And I don't think I can figure is that maybe my headlights were shining down his back window. I still don't know to this day what I did to him, but it gets to one of those where we stop at a red light, and he's talking to me with his hands, is a nice way to put it. And you can figure that out. And so he starts following me, and all I want to do is go home, because it's trust me, we were working some very, very long hours. So I get within about 3 blocks of my house, and he just won't leave me alone. So I pull off, and I whip in the street. Well, he goes up and turns and comes in the other way. So he's coming at me head to head, but he drives on by slowly, but then he stops. So the rear ends of our cars are almost touching each other. Like, okay, now what are we going to do? You know. So I'm sitting there. I got a suit on. I got my 9mm in my hand. And we're sitting there for several minutes, and, you know, it's like, dude, I just want to go home. Just leave me alone.
Yeah, because you couldn't go home because you're afraid if it wasn't the right person,
right,
that they're tracking to where you live.
He'd know where I live, exactly. Yeah. So finally, because I couldn't roll the windows down, I opened the door just a little to turn around and you know, kindly ask him, what could I help you? Well, when I opened that door, he sprayed me some type of chemical, and it went, just burned my arm. It didn't blister or anything, but I don't think it was mace, but it was more than water.
Yeah.
And so that might have ticked me off a little bit. I might have come out of the car and tuned. I gave him a tune-up on his Volkswagen, a 9mm tune-up.
Yeah.
But then, and he's in his little car trying to get the gears. And so then it hits me. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's gonna go get the police. And if I go home, my car's kind of sitting out where you can see it. So I go to the big mall is Unicentro in the north part of Bogota, and they have guards on the gate, and they search your car. And I went and sat in the parking lot for like 2 hours thinking, what kind of an idiot am I? But that's the way it really happened.
Yeah. So this is one that I love. Guys, have you ever been like in the middle of an intense conversation with your wife? Any of you? We like to call, in my home, we like to call them marital discussions. Notice I'm putting the air quotes on. We're just arguing. And so have you ever been in the middle of one of those and then something happens at work? And you, anyone, like, you know, the phone rings, that sort of stuff, you got to deal with that. So now imagine you're in the middle of a marital discussion with your spouse and the phone rings and they're like, hey, we found Pablo. You got to go find him. That's like the world's best out of a marital discussion. Right?
Well, amongst guys it is. Amongst women, not so much.
Right, because she's like, no matter what you do, we're finishing this when you get home.
Oh, yeah. She's got a long memory, too.
Yeah.
You know, it was, so I grew up, as I mentioned to you, I grew up as a preacher's kid, so you can imagine I grew up in a church and certainly have not lived a Christian lifestyle for the vast part of my life. But God has been a very strong part of my life, and I'm proud of that. So the way I understand, the way I believe the Bible is that your priorities should be God, family, and work, or your job. The truth is, amongst all, most, if not all of us in here, we have that inverted to where we have job, family, and then God. Or maybe we have job, God, and then family, but the family is not where it's supposed to be, and God's not where it's supposed to be. But my wife is a very understanding, she's tough. She's, you know, when I met her, she had her own motorcycle. How can you not love a woman that owns her own motorcycle, right? So she's very tough. But she was very understanding and she was forgiving. We've been married 32 years now, so I think it's going to last.
Yeah.
I hope. Yeah. I thought at 20 years you got a pension, but I was proven wrong on that. But it was the situation was where she understood what was going on. So if I'm up in Medellin and my partner's back in Bogota, we weren't allowed to leave. My partner and I were not allowed to leave Colombia at the same time. One of us always had to be in country. That's how high profile this case was within DEA, within the U.S. government. When I was living in Medellin, all she wanted to know was that I was okay. Well, my partner at that time, he's a really nice guy, but I'm not kidding you, we were working ourselves to death. And she'd come in the embassies in the mornings, and of course she hadn't heard from me yet. If you're out on patrol, we might go out at 4 a.m. and not get back till 10 o'clock at night. And it's a job. It's what you had to do. And all she wanted to know was that I was okay. As long as she heard I was okay, life was good. You know, and it even got kind of comical because she'd come to the door. She wouldn't even say anything. She'd just come to the door and Javier would see her and say, Steve called, he's okay, he'll call you later. And that, you know, she never said a word, but she was comforted by that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that having your priorities messed up really messes up your life.
Now, the last thing kind of in the kind of true scenario is, I don't know if many of you have studied Pablo Escobar, what he did and those sort of things, or what you may or may not know, but there's this sort of mystique, cultural mystique about that. He's sort of like Robin Hood, this devoted family man. And it is true, right, that he built homes for people. It is true that he did things like that. But there's a whole lot of stuff behind that that doesn't really get explained lots of times, right?
Right. He has this persona, which he helped create, this Robin Hood persona, and also the persona of being a devoted family man. And both of these just really irk me, to be honest with you, just to be real plain spoken about this. So look, here's the situation. You've got a large community of people who live on the edge of a trash dump. They don't have any roofs over their head. They don't have food. They go in the trash dump and get their food. They go in the trash dump and get their clothing. Anything they have comes from what other people have thrown away. So if you've been in a trash dump, you know how it smells. It's a horrible smell, right? So if you all of a sudden, if you're living in those conditions and somebody comes in and says, you know what, I'm going to build all this housing, low-income housing, and it's yours for free. And now you've got a roof over your head. You've got walls around you to keep you safe. You've got running water. You've got a bathroom. You've got electricity. What do you think of that guy? Holy cow, that's your hero, right? That's your Robin Hood. That's how he developed that persona. Then he also built a medical clinic for these people. Then he would come around, and when he was in the neighborhood, he'd stop, and they literally would pass out cash to these people because none of them have an education. They're going to have a hard time getting decent jobs doing anything, right? At Christmas time, he would pull up in big trucks, and they would give out hams and turkeys and chickens. He was giving them food. That's not because he was a Robin Hood. He's a master manipulator is what this guy is, because nothing's free. When he needed new Sicarios, I mean, at one point, this guy would travel with 300 or 400 bodyguards to protect him. That's how, I won't say he was scared. I'm not sure he was ever scared of anything. But that's what he traveled with. Well, as these guys got killed off and he needed more, he would go back to that neighborhood. Well, all he had to do was ask, and these people would do anything in the world to include giving up their own lives. So when people, you know, the media loves to say, oh, he was a Robin Hood, and you, why did you take him out? He's not a Robin Hood, he's a manipulator. He was just a master at doing that. There was a payback involved with this. And then you get over to this devoted family man, and this just really irks me. Because, and if I get up and start walking around, I apologize, but this really bothers me. So here's a man that we just told you is worth between $8 and $30 billion, right? So he got the deal of a lifetime. He pled guilty. The government, knowing that he was involved in all these murders, he pled guilty to being unwittingly participating in the transport of 300 kilos of coke. It was in the car and I didn't know, but okay, I guess I'm guilty. And the government said, great, you're guilty. All other crimes, including murder, are absolved. Okay, that's the deal of a lifetime, right? Your sentence is 5 years in your home-built prison, your own built prison.
He paid for his own prison.
He did.
Paid for his own prison, built it.
He also hand-selected his fellow prisoners, which was his brother and his cousin, and let's see, there was 11 of his Sicarios there with him. There's only 14 people.
If we had pictures of that, his prison was nicer than most of our homes.
Oh, what you see in the show, that's the one thing Netflix did not capture, was how nice the prison was. Color-coordinated draperies and upholstery in this prison, a two-room suite, jacuzzi tub, microwave oven, refrigerator, artwork on the walls, candles on the table. That's just a real nice touch in a prison cell. Yeah, that's just sickening. So not only did he handpick his own prisoners, he got to handpick his guards, and he paid them. So I wonder who they're loyal
and
to.
And the Columbia National Police was not allowed this part of the agreement within...
Right. 2 miles.
2 miles.
So the people responsible for putting them in, and I see you guys shaking your heads, and it's just ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
But now think, what led the government of Columbia to agree to that? I mean, you got all these murders, all these car bombs going off. It's desperate measures in desperate times, right?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. So anyway, so you got this man who's got the world given to him financially. I mean, never going to need anything else in his life. He's got to do 5 years' time in his custom-built prison, which is, by the way, when he did his time, the plan was to convert this over to a resort. That's how nice it was. Okay. And then he's a free man. He can walk around Columbia the rest of his life, and nobody would molest him. And, of course, he's going to have all these bodyguards because he's got more money than probably all of us in here combined, right? But is that what he chose to do? No. He couldn't get over the power and the greed and the ego, and he couldn't get over the fact that when he told you something, that was the gospel. If he told you he's going to kill you, you're dead. I mean, it's that simple. So his own psyche up here kept him from fulfilling that family thing. He could have watched his children grow up, get married, watched his grandkids grow up, things that we all aspire to do. I've got my fourth grandchild will be here in January, and I'm loving it because it's payback time to those kids. But so when people say he was a devoted family man, I just want to stick my finger down my throat and throw up. There's just nothing farther from the truth.
Yeah. All right, so third kind of true. Now let's talk about stuff that's just total literary license, right? In the trailer, when you saw the trailer, you guys stood up and saw the trailer, it kicks off in Miami. Mm-hmm. The reality of it is, and that year it shows, you were actually a police officer in Bluefield, West Virginia.
Yep.
Right?
So, anybody ever heard of Bluefield? Hey, all right.
Yeah, right.
Hi, brothers.
Yeah. You didn't, the show says you met your wife in the bowling alley. Not so.
No. My wife had just gone through a divorce, and I'd gone through a divorce, and one of her friends, who's still a friend,
yeah.
introduced us, and that's just how it started.
Yeah. But then there's some stuff to where in that they kind of create a persona of the character of Steve Murphy. One is, if you see the show, taking life for Steve Murphy is not a problem in the show, and taking many lives, but not true.
Not true. I've never killed a single person in my life. I've been in a lot of shootouts. I've had an informant killed in Miami, and my partner got shot in Miami. I've killed a couple buildings and a couple cars, but never killed a person.
Yeah. And in that, as we talk, you know, I've said that. I consider, and it just makes you uncomfortable, and just get over it, I consider you a hero. You know, giving of yourself, giving of those sort of stuff. But it says right here, under the things you think are not true, that you're not a hero. Why do you say that?
You know, and that's a great title to have. And I appreciate when people say that. But the reality is, my partner and I are professional law enforcement officers. And we were doing a job. We were assigned to work a case. Now, it was a big case. We knew that. And we knew we'd probably never work another case of that magnitude the rest of our career. So we knew what we were into there. But the reality is, we were doing our job that we were paid to do, just like you do your job every day. And you know what? When that case was over, and this was in December 93, we celebrated there for a few weeks, and my wife and I actually came back to the United States for 3 weeks and celebrated Christmas. But when we got back to work, what's the next case? Move on to the next operation. So simply because it was a big case doesn't make us a hero. I mean, yeah, it was a big case. But what we tell everybody, and we say this in every presentation that we give, and I mean, just so you know, we're probably doing about 90 presentations this year, so this is something we do frequently, is in our book, the true heroes are the Columbia National Police. Because I knew, and Javier knew, at the end of our tour of duty down there, we got to come back to the United States. If you've never lived in a foreign country, let me tell you, and Columbia's nice, but it will make you appreciate living here in the United States. Regardless of what's going on in politics and everything else, this is the best place in the entire world. Okay, so the real heroes were the Columbia National Police because they had to stay. They had to continue to face this. If Escobar wasn't killed at the end of 93 and my tour was up in mid-94, I still would have come back to the United States and those guys would have still been down there fighting the fight. But also, their families were exposed to it. And they're not making any money. I was good friends with a Colombian police captain that made $600 a month. And he's a captain. That's a pretty high rank. The other heroes down there were all the innocents that were killed just simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that was probably the biggest danger for us. Well, there was actually two big dangers. One was being in the wrong place at the wrong time and a car bomb goes off. And so if that happens, there's nothing you can do about it, right? The other danger I faced was that we had $300,000 price tags on our heads put there by Pablo Escobar, and I was always worried my wife might try and collect on that. She still talks about that.
Yeah, every once in a while. Well, the last one is, I think, is deeply important because there's something I think that all of us men can be tempted to believe. You know, we live in a culture, right, where being a dependent person on someone else isn't something to be proud of as men, right? We want to be independent. We want to think of ourselves as self-sufficient, survive by our own means. And that's really, in many ways, kind of how they portray you in this show, that you survived under your own means. Not true.
No. I think at different points in our lives as men, we think, we like to think we're tough guys, right? Regardless of what your job is or what your upbringing is. And when I was younger, I used to pretend I was a tough guy. as a city police officer in southern West Virginia in the mid-70s, it was still a pretty rough time, and you did a lot of fighting, but you know, the truth is I got my butt kicked a lot. But other guys would show up and help you out. So you go through all this training, and you know, you think you're ready to tackle the biggest drug trafficker in the world. Truth is, the only reason I'm sitting here talking to you today is from the grace of God. You know, a lot of people asking the question in our question and answer, and you may be wondering this now, and I'll just beat you to the punch a little bit, but people say, weren't you scared down there? And honestly, I'm not an overly brave person, and a lot of you guys in here know me, and I think I'm pretty easygoing. But there wasn't anything special that we did to stay alive. We didn't do stupid things, but you still had to face dangers. For example, when we had the Delta Force and the Navy SEALs there with us, best operators in the world. And I love those guys. I still do. In fact, I'm still on a Booz Allen contract where I get to go teach them a few times a year down in Damn Neck, Virginia. But they were confined to the base in Medellin. Well, you know what? Javier and I were confined to the base too. But at the very beginning of this second manhunt, we sat down and literally talked face to face. How are we going to do this? We said, you know what? If you stay in the rear and collect intel and then expect the Colombian National Police to go out and face the danger, what are they going to think about you? Are they going to respect us? Are they going to continue to work with us? Are they going to share the information that we can share with DEA worldwide or FBI or whatever agencies? Of course not. I mean, just think about if hey, I just got this information that Pablo's down here at the corner of First and Main. Go check it out and come back and tell me what you find out. I'll be back here. You know, what do you think about me? So I'm taking a long way to get to the short answer here. I truly believed, and to this day, I believe that God has preordained my entire life, that he knows exactly what's going to happen every day, every minute to me, what he has planned. He gives me opportunities to make my own decisions. He presents me with opportunities, and I decide if I'm going to participate or not. But I also believe that when my time is up in God's eyes, I can be sitting here talking to you tonight and fall off dead off this chair, or I could be in Colombia fighting a drug war and get killed by a stray bullet from Pablo Escobar. I just don't lose a minute's sleep over when I'm going to die. Now, the one thing I forgot to bring, you know, forgive me, Lord, is I usually carry my Bible when I'm up here doing these things. Yeah. And what I call that is the instruction book. So I looked at I jumped ahead. I read the last chapter. And you know what I found out? I win. Either way. Whether I'm here on earth with you folks or I'm up in heaven, because I know where I'm going.
Yeah. 1 Corinthians is in the New Testament, it just says this. It says, death, where's your sting? Grave, where's your victory? And it's not saying that death isn't a difficult thing or that the grave isn't real, but it's saying that it's for those of us who have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, we know where we're going. We can not fear what is next. Because when this life ends, absent of the body, present with God. You know, and that's something that carries you through. And also, you know, Steve, you found yourself in an interesting place now in life. We talk about being reminded that if you didn't survive then by your own means, also today, who you are is what God sees you as, not what other people sees you as. And I think as men, there's this temptation, right? We want to feel good about ourselves based upon what's on our business card or what's in our bank account or that sort of thing, and to get significance from that. The reality is that we get significance from the fact that because God loves us, he sent Jesus to die for us, and we have a relationship with God. That's our deepest significance. But there's this constant sort of fight now, I think in all of our lives, but it's unique in yours. We were sitting and we were talking about the second season premiere. This time they paid for you to come out to Hollywood, right? Because yeah. They made money off the first season. And you're sitting in this theater, a big, huge, packed theater, and they show the first episode of season two. And right before it started, so you were like right down here in the second row, right? And there was some young people up in the front row, and everyone was there trying to meet someone, be someone, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so a guy stood up, and he turned around, and on the back of the screen was a picture of Pablo, all right? And he tried to take a selfie of himself, and you offered to take the picture for him, right? What'd you tell him?
I said, hey, for $5, I'll take that picture for you.
Yeah, you know, which is pretty cheap, right? Because out on Hollywood Boulevard, they charge you $10 to take a picture for the guy dressed up like Darth Vader or whatever, right?
Yep.
So you offered to do that, and what did he do to you?
He blew you off. He just kind of looked at me like, yeah, right, old man.
Yeah, right, old man. Now, fast forward an hour, done playing. Second highest executive in Netflix gets up, talks about Narcos, and says, tonight we have some special guests with us. And they point to the old man in the second row.
That's Javier.
Yeah, that's Javier. That's your partner, right? and you, right? What changed?
Oh, they turned around and looked at us and like, oh my gosh, we said that to him?
Yeah. Now all of a sudden people want to talk to you, right?
Yeah.
They want to be around you. Well, in those moments, that's not who you are.
No.
What do you have to remember?
You know, and so it was a cool experience. I mean, we got to walk the red carpet. You know, we got to sign autographs and have our pictures taken and give interviews to the Hollywood Reporter and all these different things. And it's real easy to get caught up in that glitter and that glitz that's going along. But and then you watch the first show, we got to go to the after party and there's all these pretty people there. And now, you know, just so you don't know, I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink any alcohol at all. I used to. I started having allergic reactions to it, and I figured that was God telling me my alcohol full light was coming on, so I just stopped drinking altogether. I don't condemn people. If you drink, I'm fine with that. And the reality is I'll go to a bar with you, but I just choose not to drink. So we're at this party, and everybody's just getting toasted, and there's all these big, big, important people there, and other actors show up, and it's kind of impressive. But, you know, when we came home, you finally calmed down because it was just, it was one thing after another and limos picking you up, taking you places. I drive a pickup truck. So this was kind of nice to be chauffeured around. And it's like you see on TV, but you finally experience. So we come home, and my wife and I, we're just kind of reflecting on the week we'd spent in L.A. And the one thing that we took away was, you know what? There wasn't anything but just fake. That's what we remembered about the whole thing. There was nothing genuine or real about any of that we experienced. And you know what? Now that season 3, they've already started filming season 3, but, you know, Pablo's dead, so Murphy's out of it. You'll actually see Pena in season 3 as a supervisor, which is what really happened because he went back in 1999. But now that I'm out of it, I don't get any phone calls from Hollywood. I don't get any. If I send emails, I might get a response, and I might not.
Yeah.
But that's what sticks with you is none of that was real. It's just all fake.
So, and that's the thing that we're trying to drive home tonight. You know, I doubt anyone's going to be in the situation that you are, but all of us will be in those moments where there's an impression of you. And the temptation for us will be to live out of that which is not true, the literary license part. You know, and we're always going to be tempted to live on reputation or live on what other people think of us, but all of that changes, right? Mm-hmm. And it's changed already for you in that way. But what God thinks of us, that never changes. That never changes. And the message that we wanted to share together tonight, if you've come, is simply this. No matter who you are, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you are going to go through or what you're in right now, God loves you. And he cares for you. And he sees you as valuable. And the reality of it is that we don't survive this world under our own means. Doesn't matter how much money we have in the bank account. And I guarantee you, maybe no one in this room is worth $8 billion, but in Northern Virginia, somebody in this room is worth a lot of money. But you don't survive on that. You don't survive on your hard work, even though those are good things. But ultimately, we survive by the grace of God. And the good news is that the grace of God is available to all of us. It never runs out. He doesn't look at us and go, man, you really messed up, you really messed up, you really messed up. You don't have this, you know, none for you. But no matter where you are, no matter what's going on in your life, it's available for you. And that's what we want you to know. And if that's something that you want to know more about tonight, you don't know more about that. I'll be down front, Pastor Bruce will be down front, any other men that you want to be down front. Don't leave tonight hearing, I just heard something great about a guy who went out, and as you would say, sometimes life puts you at the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. It's what we choose to do in that moment, and you chose to act. Tonight, maybe God has put you here at the right place at the right time so he could remind you how much he cares for you.
He could remind you that you don't have to live in this life without hope, that you can know where you're going when you die. So that you can say, hey, whether it's today you drop dead or whether it's tomorrow or whatever it may be, you have confidence. That's our greatest desire tonight for you in that way. And so, So I'm going to pray, and then, yeah, we got microphones, right? And something, I'm sure I didn't say anything that you're interested in, but Steve's, you know, we'll do that. God, thank you for who you are. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for the protection that he gives. Thank you for Steve answering the call to serve you, how you gave him the opportunity to serve. Thank you for his story and how in his story, as fantastic as it is, he reminds us that it is God. It is you, God, who kept him through it. Thanks for tonight. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Gentlemen, if you have any questions for Steve, you can please come up to one of the microphones on either side and ask your question. And he'd be glad to try to give you either a real answer or a fake.
Yeah, I'll make it up. And while you're getting rest, I'll take a picture of y'all.
Here you go. Why don't you stand? I'll take a picture.
Why don't you get one first?
All right. $5, yeah. You guys need to learn. It's at least 10.
Wait, let me.
At least 10.
If I jump down, I'll hurt myself.
I'll use a skinny lens. I'll make you look skinny. You just stand right there. Yeah. Two. I think I got it. I'm an iPhone geek. Go ahead.
Quick question about your progression of your career from being a cop in a small town in West Virginia to being put in the DEA on a biggest case that they had going. Tell me about that.
Well, so I got to stand up now. He makes me sit down, but I like to stand up and walk.
I don't make you do anything.
So, quite honestly, I never wanted to be anything other than a cop my whole life, even since I was a little kid. And my father, when he retired from the ministry, he and my uncle, we were living in Tennessee at the time. I'm originally from Tennessee, but I went to high school and college in West Virginia. So, when we moved to West Virginia, that was after my father retired from the ministry, he and my uncle opened a carpet store. And I don't know if you've ever done carpet, but it is back-breaking work. Those guys earn their money, and I hated it. But I was the only son in both families, so it was always anticipated that, you know, Steak was going to take over the carpet business. And so I started off at West Virginia University, and that first semester when I came home for Christmas on academic probation, my dad said, yeah, you're not going back. We don't pay for that. So I came home and went to a local college. But what I didn't tell my dad is I changed my major to criminal justice, and I loved it. So I became a cop. I was 19 years old when I became a police officer. Now, I could carry a gun. I could shoot you if I deemed it necessary. I could put you in jail and take your freedom away. But I could not buy a gun, and I couldn't buy bullets, which was kind of ridiculous. Back then, you had to provide your own weapon. So my dad bought my gun, and the city gave me my bullets. Just a silly story. It's crazy, isn't it? So I did that for 6 years, and then I joined the railroad police and moved to Norfolk, Virginia for 5.5 years, and got to be friends with another railroad police officer, Pete Ramey, lives down in Christiansburg, still lives there. He was a former Virginia State Trooper, and he was assigned to the DEA task force in Roanoke, and he would tell me about the drug cases he worked, and I really got interested in that, and got in a shootout on the railroad police, helping the city police, and my boss, who had never been a real policeman, came in and decided he was going to fire me for that, and I just thought, I'm not working for an organization that, you know, that acts like that. Now, the big bosses in Roanoke took care of me and nothing happened, but it just gave me the incentive to finish college, and so I put in for DEA, took 2 years to get the job, got posted in Miami to start with, so my career, I went hired on in West Virginia, then went to, after Quantico, went to Miami, then to Bogota, then to Greensboro, North Carolina. So I spent 4 years in Miami, 3 years in Columbia, and I'm going to get up in Greensboro. Now, this is God's country, let me tell you. It's a beautiful place. And when I got there, I'm looking around like, why are we even here? I mean, I've been in Miami, I've been in Columbia, and now I'm here. But let me tell you, every place in the United States has drug problems. So after Greensboro, I went to Atlanta, then Washington, then Atlanta, then Washington, and retired here. So that's my career.
Yes, so I apologize if this question is sounds a little vague, but what is like one actionable thing that we can take away from, I guess, that from your experience or something that you would recommend that each one of us do in order to live in that quote-unquote first third?
Wow. gosh, there's actually, I can think of several things here. First of all, I really recommend reading the instruction book, which is called the Bible. And do like I did, jump to the very end, read the last chapter first. It'll scare you is what it'll do. I think I can go up against drug traffickers and not be afraid, but read Revelations, and it's a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
We're covering it in our Bible study now, Saturday mornings. From a law enforcement standpoint, or from this could be a church view, or it could be a secular view, but the one thing that I have learned, and when we promote this now, is that we cannot arrest our way out of the drug problem in this country. Now, the United States is the leading consumer country of illegal narcotics in the entire world. Now, there's a reputation we love to have, right? But it's the sad truth. So we can't do away with enforcement. I mean, you still got to have penalties for crimes, right? But we need better education. You know, and it's easy to say, what's the answer to that? I wish I had the answer, because I would be independently wealthy if I could come up with that answer. I'd still come and talk to you, by the way, but I might have more than $60 in my pocket. I might have as much money as Brad over there. Got my own, buddy. So, but you know, another thing we need is we need the home life to accept responsibility and raise children the right way. You can't expect the schools to raise your children the right way. You can't expect your neighbors. The closest that you can expect is bringing them into the church, where you've got a God-centered environment to help you raise your children. But parents have to be responsible for their children and teach them what's right, teach them what's wrong. How do you get to do that? If you're in a very urban environment where you have families, whether or not, I'm not even sure that you'd call them a family. You have a mother that has multiple children by multiple fathers who really doesn't take an interest in the children, because maybe they're addicted to drugs, or they're addicted to whatever, or they just don't care, or life's too hard, or they don't have the education. There's a variety of factors, and I certainly don't mean to put any of those people down, but how do we get them to step up to the plate?
Yeah, and as we were talking before, just as men, don't buy the lie that I have a great career and I can step out on my family. You know, I personally believe, and we've talked this before, when you stand before God, he's probably going to ask you this question: what have you done with what I entrusted you with? Mm-hmm. And I believe I can make a case in the Bible that means the spouse I've given you and the kids who did not have the choice to come into that family. So what good does it do to have the best business card, the best bank account, the best that, and your children not have a relationship with them? I mean, because how many people do you know that's in that first scenario, but also the second scenario, very affluent families. Families do very, very well, but they don't actually have a home life. Mm-hmm. And so these kids go and they try to seek life from something that they shouldn't get it from.
And so, you know, where's the young man that asked that question? I lost you. Oh, there you are. Okay. Please don't anybody take what I'm saying as a pompous attitude, because this is something that I don't tell many people, but I will tell you, I've got four children, and I'm saying that parents should be held responsible. My second son, who's 36 years old, is in prison in West Virginia now, doing 3 years for heroin addiction, opioid addiction, and stealing to fund that addiction. So should I be held responsible? I wish I had the answers. But I'm going to tell you, there's only one answer. God's the only answer. To this problem, to the political situation we have here, whatever your problems might be, there's only one answer that's going to work. Man, any of us, as tough as we think we are not going to resolve this issue. We've got to go to God.
Just want to say thanks for coming, first of all. It's been really interesting. I hope this isn't too personal, but especially the second season of Narcos, I think my favorite part is the way that you and Javier kind of wrestle with demons as far as like doing anything and bending the rules to move forward. I don't know how much of that is Hollywood, so I just was kind of interested if there was anything that you specifically regret or wish you had done differently in that situation.
No, and I'll tell you, The part that they show Javier with all the girls, now he had a lot of girlfriends, but none of them were prostitutes, none of them were informants, and none of them were communists. Okay, he's never been married, so the man had girlfriends. Okay, he's got a funny comment, but I probably shouldn't say that in church. So, catch me in a parking lot. But where they portray him passing off classified intelligence to the Cali cartel, to Julie Moncada, to Judy Moncada, to Big Fat Guy, Don Berna. Those are real people that we actually had to deal with them. Don Berna, who we didn't know at the time was one of our informants, was one of the creators of Los Pepes. We didn't know it until 1999. Escobar was killed in 1993, so our intel wasn't 100% right. So, but anyway, Javier was not passing classified intel the way they portrayed in the show. I was not on helicopters when they were throwing people out the door, although there were times when I might want to be. So that's Hollywood. So there's really not a lot of regrets. We told them the true story. Honestly, there is no one, there's no two people more surprised than Javier and I are than from the success of the show. We actually blew two producers off on this, where we talked to them, and the first guy wanted to make a right-wing political statement out of it. The second guy was even goofier than that. I'm still not sure what he wanted, other than he wanted me to buy this book for $25 from him, and I did, and I still don't know any more than before I read the book. And so you get your hopes up that, you know, I'm thinking, God, what am I going to do after DEA? Because federal law enforcement mandatory retirement age is 57. And I was 55 when this was going on. I thought, what am I going to do? And I never wanted to leave law enforcement. I love being a cop. I did it for 38 years. You know the old saying, if you find a job you like, you never work a day in your life? I found the job. I mean, I loved it. Even when I retired, my family, my sons came up and were like, Dad, you are DEA. What are you going to do, you know, in retirement? And so you get your hopes up that something's going to happen with these producers, and when you just see it going, you know, skewed off to the side, you get really disappointed. You get depressed. It's like, man, I knew nobody liked this idea. Why are we even trying this? And so Javier and I said, forget it. Well, then I get a call. So when you ask, if you don't believe God will answer your prayers, just try him. But be careful what you ask for. You better be ready for it. Because I said, God, show me what it is you want me to do. Where am I going to go from DEA? Now, the administrators came. We made it up to the senior executive service ranks, which in government service is the highest you can get without a presidential appointment. So, or an attorney general. Well, no, the attorney general approves the SES. But anyway, so we're up there. You know, I'm about four grades higher than I should be. So the administrator offered each of us a three-year extension, so we stayed till 60, and that would have gotten my kids through college, and I still love the job, and so we accepted. Well, I'm driving out of headquarters one day, and my cell phone rings, and it's this retired U.S. Marine that I'd worked with in Columbia. I haven't talked to this guy in over 20 years. We do a little catching up, and he says, hey, there's a guy in Hollywood who wants to talk to you. And I'm like, no, we've been down this road. And any former Marines in here? I know there are. Yeah, so you guys don't take no very well. So, and you know that, right? I mean, you already know that. So he's like, I haven't talked to you in over 20 years, and you can't do me a favor. And I'm like, whoa, okay. So I call this guy in Hollywood, and so he starts this little spiel, and I try to blow him off. Well, he's the executive producer of Narcos. His name is Eric Newman. He said, if I come to Washington with two writers, would you just have dinner? That's all I'm asking, just have dinner. Well, I'm here tonight working for food. I work for food. I'm good with that. So I did, and these guys, they stood up. You know, they were stand-up guys. Just hit it off, and that's how Narcos came along. But we told them at the very beginning, this is going to be a colossal waste of money. I'm not supposed to know this, but for season one, they spent $90 million to produce season one and advertise it and market it and all that stuff. That's, you know, my contract wasn't anywhere near. I just wanted $1 million, and I couldn't even get that. So not even close to it. So where were we going with this? So that's how the whole thing came about. So when Narcos was a hit and they called us back for season two, we're like, holy cow. Well, now Narcos, in Netflix world, their number one show ever is House of Cards, if you've ever seen that. And I watched it. I don't particularly like it, but it's about politics. I don't particularly care for politics. But we got a call.
Well, in this environment, not many of us do.
Yeah, right now, that's for sure. But we got a call a few weeks ago from one of the Netflix officials that said, Netflix is rivaling House of Cards for the number one show ever. So when I say nobody's more surprised than us, I mean that now we're writing a book. And I don't think anybody will buy the book. But, you know, I was proven wrong with Narcos, so we'll see what happens. It's just where God wants you to go. It's where he takes you.
Yeah, I just had a question. Obviously, one of the reasons Escobar achieved such popularity was because of the economic disparity in the country at the time. He became a popular figure, the Robin Hood and so forth. What was your view of that? Obviously, I know what your heartfelt view is, but mm-hmm. there was a huge gap between the haves and the have-nots, and I think that fed into his rise to power of some sort.
It did. And you hit the nail on the head, because there was no middle class back in the day in Columbia. It's exactly what that man said. Is you had the haves and you had the have-nots. You had the very wealthy and the very poor. Excuse me. So you didn't have that middle class, and he capitalized on that. Now, the haves would not accept him simply because of his wealth, okay? Because they most of them came from old world money, okay? So it was already in the family, and these are really extremely wealthy people and are still going on today. But they're also some very nice people, and they're earning the majority of them have earned their income through legitimate businesses. You know, it's not illegal means that they attained all this wealth. But you look at Escobar, he tried to legitimize himself by running for Congress down there, if you didn't know that. And he was actually elected as an alternate for his congressional district. And then after the election, the primary resigned his position, which bumped Pablo up to the primary for his congressional district. And the guy didn't die. Yeah, so you know he got paid off, right? Because most of the time Pablo would just kill people that were in his way. But how it's portrayed in the show, where Pablo shows up the first time to go into the congressional session, and he doesn't have a tie on, that's true. You know, a bailiff or one of the sergeant-at-arms or whatever gave him a tie to put on, and he went in there. Well, people were so afraid of him, people wouldn't challenge him. But there was one guy, the Minister of Justice, Laura Bonilla was his last name, eventually had the guts to stand up and call Pablo what he was. So if you remember in the show where they show Pablo getting arrested that first time and they're taking his mugshot and he keeps laughing and he drops the sign and he's just toying with the police officers, but in his mugshot, he's smiling. So I'm not asking you to raise your hand if you've ever had your mugshot taken, but that's a picture you don't smile in, okay? Well, he thought, so now fast forward, remember when the guerrillas, M19, attacked the Palace of Justice in Colombia? Remember, I don't remember the year that happened, but that's a true event. The whole, what year? 85? There you go. Thank you. So what those guys did, their whole purpose was Escobar hired them to go in and destroy the evidence room because that's where all the evidence was against him. One of the things that survived was that very first mugshot because he was on a platform, I've never been arrested for anything. Oh, yes, he was. And Laura Bonilla produced that in an open congressional session, which obviously embarrassed Pablo. He never came back to Congress. What happened to Laura Bonilla? He didn't last very long. He was in his chauffeur-driven car, and a motorcycle pulled up with a rider on it. And as they stopped at a red light, the rider opened up with a .45 Mac-10 and killed Laura Bonilla. The judges down there, I mean, it was so violent for the judges that they created what they called the faceless judges. And these judges literally wore hoods or they sat behind curtains so that people couldn't see their face, so they couldn't be identified because all the judges were being killed. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the violence that was going on. Anybody that got in a man's way, he just took them out. That was his answer. All right, don't be bashful. I'll stand here and talk all night about this if y'all have questions. So, yes, sir. Oh, there was. It was ugly. I'm trying to think of nice words to say here. It was very confrontational. We did not get along at all. We were boots on the ground. So there was a CIA guy stationed with us up in Medellin in this compound. And this police base was like one of our military bases. It had an inner perimeter, outer perimeter. You had machine gun pillboxes everywhere. You had the serpentine driveways to get in and all that kind of stuff. But between the inner and outer perimeter were private citizens. So you had communities in there, which is kind of tough. You know, you don't see that on our bases. But anybody could infiltrate that, you know. So it was always, one of the challenges. But the CIA guy did not go off the base. He abided by the rules. Well, Javier and I didn't. We weren't breaking any laws. We were just breaking rules. You know, you break a rule, you might get fired, but you're not going to go to jail for it. So, and it's kind of funny that the reception we got from a lot of our bosses when they found out we were breaking the rules, said, just like, hey, go do what you got to do. Get the job done. That's that. Now, in today's environment, you wouldn't get that response. But dealing with CIA, so we're writing, every time all these activities are going down, we're sending teletypes to headquarters so they could be abreast of what's going on. Well, finally, we got authorization to see some of the CIA reporting. Well, to do that, we had to go up on their floor, and when you walk in the door, they turn a little blue light on, and that means, when that blue light's flashing, that means you're not supposed to be in here, but we're going to let you in, just out of the greatest, you know, goodness of our hearts, because we're just like that. These guys are jerks. So when we go down to read their teletypes or maybe look at some of the photography they had, because eventually we got access to U2 photography. Now that's cool. I mean, that's a man's kind of thing right there. You know, looking at satellite photography or high altitude photography from U2s. I just think that's really cool. And you had all these other assets available to you. Well, for us to look at any of this information, they had a little school desk. And so right here is the corner office where the chief of station, the main guy for the CIA, sat, and his deputy sat here. And we would sit at this little school desk so that both of them could look at us as we're flipping through, looking at pictures and reading these cables. Well, I read the first cable, and it says, the following information is attributed to a trusted and reliable source of information. So I should be proud that they call me trusted and reliable. But I read the teletype I wrote yesterday that I sent to Washington. They didn't change the words or anything. They just plagiarized the whole thing and took credit for the information that's going out. So that kind of creates a little competition and a bad taste in your mouth. And just one quick story, because you guys are going to love this. So the CIA guy that's with us in Medellin, his name is Paul. And so we have this wiretap room in Medellin. And to get into our wiretap room, you had to go in the colonel's office, who was in charge of the whole base. He had a recessed bookcase. You reach in there and hit the little hidden button, and the bookcase would come out of the wall. I mean, this is like James Bond stuff. You know, you step through the wall, close the bookcase behind you, and there's your wire room. It's pretty cool. Of course, there's another door in there. It leads right out into the quad, so it's no big deal. But it was kind of cool to walk through that bookcase. So the CIA says, you know what? We need a wire room. And so they go to the colonel, and they convince him. And, of course, they got a whole lot more money than we had. So he gives them space right next to our wire room, and they bring in all the latest and greatest equipment. They can run about 30 lines where we could only run about 15. But our wires were monitored by the Columbia National Police. The CIA didn't do that. They brought in their own monitors to listen to these calls. And so after they'd been running a couple of days, the colonel says, okay, Paul, come in. And he goes in, he says, what do you got for me? And Paul's like, well, colonel, you know, we're getting a lot of good intercepts. Well, we haven't found anything that pertains to you. And the colonel's like, what do you mean pertains to me? Everything that you collect on those wires pertains to me. This is my base. He's like, no, that's not the way this works. You know, if it's related to the Columbia National Police, we're going to give it to you. But if it's related to the guerrillas and all the stuff that we are responsible for, you know, if something comes up, we'll let you know. So the colonel, you know, he just wasn't too happy about that, and he gave it a couple of days, and he calls Paul back in. He says, what do you got for me now? And Paul says, we still haven't gotten a thing that pertains to you. And he says, colonel's got a fuse about that long. He says, you know what, Paul? Pack your crap and get out. You're done. Of course, Paul's scrambling now because they've invested all his time and money getting this wire room set up and everything. But the colonel's just, you know, he made a decision and that's it. So the day that Pablo's killed, you see that picture and it looks like I was there. I wasn't there when Pablo killed. That was the Colombian National Police. That's one of the reasons we call them the heroes. That little group of guys that we worked with, those are the guys that attacked that row house that day, got in the firefight with Pablo, and they're the ones that succeeded and came out successful. I wasn't there. I was back at the base with Colonel Martinez. Actually rode from the base to the site with Colonel Martinez. Okay, so anyway, I'm standing in the doorway with all the Americans, with the Delta guys and the Navy SEALs, because they're, like I said, they're studs, man. I love them. So if you've read that book, Killing Pablo, Mark Bowden will lead you to believe at towards the end that there was a sniper shot that hit Pablo in the ear. I'm here to tell you firsthand, I examined the body. I was the only person that had a camera out there. So all the cameras that were taken until the morgue, the medical, it's not really a medical examiner, it's more of a morgue came out. But all those pictures, I took those pictures. I have enough experience with murders that I know what gunshot residue is. And that's kind of getting to another story. But I know that there was no sniper that killed Pablo Escobar because I was standing in the room with all the Americans. Colombians, God love them, I love them, but they don't have that skill like our guys do, okay? So if you ask, if you go to down to North Carolina, you ask the Delta guys now, hey, did one of your guys kill Pablo Escobar? They don't say yes, they don't say no, they just go, just leave that mystique out there. I'm okay with that. So anyway, I'm standing there with all the Americans, and I see a lot of activity in the quad, and people are going to Colonel's office. I'm like, hey, guys, something's going on. I'll be back. Go over to the Colonel's office, and that's when I'm listening to him. Hey, we found him. I saw him looking out the window. The Colonel is telling his son, Lieutenant Martinez. So Colonel Martinez is in charge. His son, Lieutenant Martinez, is the guy that actually found Pablo Escobar using radio directional finding equipment, because the cell phones back in that day were nothing more than radio phones that operated off of radio frequencies, okay? So they've triangulated, they've kind of narrowed him down, and the lieutenant's driving down the street holding out a little handheld antenna, and his little meter is telling him which way to look, and it's getting stronger, and looks up and actually sees Pablo Escobar staring out the window. Calls his dad, hey, I've got him. I've actually seen him. And the colonel says, we're mounting the troops now. You don't just grab 600 guys and jump in the car and go down someplace. It takes a little while to get everybody to get their gear together, load your weapons, because you don't let these guys run around with loaded weapons on a base. It takes a little bit of time. So this small unit, this is one of the things they learned from the Delta guys, which I really like. They used det cord to blow the front door off that row house. And, you know, it don't sound like much when I say it like that, but if you've ever done it, it's really cool. It just, you see it, and the door's gone. Know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah, see? So, there you go. And so they run in, and this is a three-level row house. And so Pablo's on the second floor getting ready to go to the third floor. And one of our guys, as he's running up the steps, Pablo goes to shoot at him. The guy trips and falls, which is what saved his life, because the bullet went over his head. Now, in the show, they'll show you that as soon as the guys make the assault, first thing you do, first guy comes around the corner, Pablo pops him right there. I think he pops like two or three more. Not a single good guy was shot that day. The only person who was shot was Pablo Escobar. So, you know, this is all going on. We're getting everything together. Well, Paul comes up and he's like, hey, Colonel, I'm here to get my equipment. Can I borrow a truck? And the Colonel's like, go rent a truck. Okay, well, could I get some boxes from you? And he said, when you're renting a truck, go buy the boxes and put in the truck and bring them back over, because we're not giving you anything. Well, could I get some manpower? No, you brought it in here, you pack it up and get out. Get out before sundown. So Paul comes over to us and he's like, hey guys, you know, I'm American, you're American, could you help me? And it's like, are you kidding me? As many times as you've done me, I don't think so. And of course the military guys just laugh at him. So as Pablo Escobar is being assaulted and killed, and we're mounting up to go out there, here's the CIA guy over there carrying his little boxes of equipment out to his truck. I just thought that was a perfect ending to the whole thing, you know.
Well, speaking of perfect endings, I think we're getting near our time, right?
We're very near our time. One last question, if it's easy. Last question. Okay. Let's give a big hand to Steve.